You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And in this episode, I get back on Dr. Michael Greenberg. Michael is a licensed clinical psychologist. He is director of OCD Associates, a practice specializing in rumination-focused ERP. Now, I previously did an episode with Michael called Rumination is a Compulsion. It was quite a popular episode, and I got him on to expand on that and how he uses ERP, but he focuses it around tackling rumination. So his approach is a little different. So when you listen to this episode, weigh it up, think for yourself, and come to your own conclusions. But it was a very interesting chat with Michael, and in it we specifically talk about why rumination is a compulsion, rumination-focused exposure and response prevention therapy, how his approach to treating OCD doesn't fit with the habituation model of ERP, but how it's closer to the inhibitory learning model of OCD. He gives examples of how he does ERP, how and why he focuses on getting his clients' anxiety close to zero before doing any ERP exercise, why he focuses on eliminating rumination first before physical compulsions, the difference between thinking normally and ruminating, noticing when you are ruminating, and much, much more. And thanks to NoCD for sponsoring this show. To find out more about NoCD and their therapy plans, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories or click the link in the episode description. So thanks to those guys, and as always, thank you so much to you all for listening to the podcast. And without further ado, here is Michael. Welcome back to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. So most people, I'm sure, would have listened to our first episode, Rumination is a Compulsion. Definitely check that out. I'll put a link in the show notes for those that haven't heard it. But just to give a recap, why is rumination a compulsion? I guess, why did we title that episode that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what we mean by compulsion is something that somebody feels compelled to do because they are scared. They feel like they don't have a choice. But to do this to protect themselves from whatever it is that they're afraid of, like the core fear. So by saying that rumination is a compulsion, we're saying that it is, what we're saying is that it's something that you're doing to protect yourself. But what we're really saying is that it's something that you have control over that you're doing to protect yourself. That's really the fact that it's a compulsion is less significant than the fact that you have control over it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And the reason it's so crucial to distinguish between obsessions and compulsions is because the whole premise of this treatment is that we're not trying to get rid of an obsession, but we are getting rid of a compulsion. And so if where you draw the line between mental phenomena is off, if you get it wrong, then you are either trying to get rid of a thought occurring to you, which you can't, that's thought suppression, that will get you into trouble, or else you are allowing a certain amount of compulsion to remain there, a certain amount of engagement, and the person doesn't get better. So you really have to know where that line is. So that's really, I think, the most important piece. It's not that rumination is a compulsion, it's how much of what's going on mentally is a compulsion and how much of it therefore needs to go.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So my next question was kind of setting this up. How does your approach to treating OCD differ from a more stereotypical ERP standard?
Yeah, okay. So I think that the answer to that is multifold. I think that I'm going to focus on two ways that it's different. First of all, it is different because of how we conceptualize anxiety in general. And then it's also different because of how we conceptualize OCD and ERP. So in terms of the first one, it's different because we conceptualize anxiety as the product or actually the experience of rumination. So we're saying that when you feel anxious, what's actually happening is that you're ruminating. And you are feeling anxious, that's true. But what you might be missing is that cognitively what's happening is that you're engaging with this problem and trying to solve it. And therefore, the whole idea of habituation goes out the window. Because if you conceptualize anxiety as evidence of a behavior, you can't habituate to a behavior. No matter how long you're doing a behavior, you're not going to stop doing it. So just like you could be, I don't know, pick a behavior for the rest of your life, you could also ruminate for the rest of your life. And as long as you're doing it, you'll keep being anxious, and there's no such thing as habituation to that. Okay. So that's sort of one big distinction. And then the other big distinction is it's based on a much simpler model of OCD and ERP. So rather than this behaviorist model of negative reinforcement and habituation, et cetera, this model is simply OCD is compulsion and avoidance. If you eliminate compulsion and avoidance, you eliminate OCD. Very straightforward model. The purpose of ERP is to eliminate compulsion and avoidance. And exposure is always for the purpose of either eliminating avoidance or else eliminating compulsion. There is no value to any exposure outside of that. Once you discard the role of habituation and focus on eliminating compulsion and avoidance, you very much streamline exactly what to do as exposure and exactly why you're doing it. So it takes a kind of messy treatment. And for those who are not familiar, like ERP sounds very clean on paper, right? Just, confront the trigger and don't do the compulsion. But in practice, how you do an exposure and why you do an exposure and what to do as exposure is actually very messy. And there's a lot of room to do things one way or another. And so this approach very much streamlines what you do as exposure and suggests really only two types of exposure. It gets rid of the idea of habituation. It gets rid of the idea of being anxious on purpose. It gets rid of the idea of basically those two things. And it leaves you with two types of exposure. Either eliminate avoidance, do anything you're avoiding, or confront a trigger for the sole purpose of eliminating compulsion. Confront a trigger so you can practice confronting a trigger and eliminating compulsion. So it's very straightforward. Another significant difference, therefore, is that we're not doing anything that normal people don't do. There's nothing extreme. There's nothing creative. We're eliminating avoidance, meaning anything that anybody else does, you should be able to do. And we're eliminating compulsion. Anything that other people don't do, you don't need to do, right? So it's still exposure and it's still response prevention, but why you're doing it is different. And therefore what you're doing for it, like what the target is for the exposure, is much more straightforward, much more limited, and there's a lot less room for interpretation, which makes the treatment a lot more precise and a lot faster. That makes sense?
Yeah.
And then I think the other piece I would want to add is that the way we conceptualize OCD is that what makes something a compulsion is a person's subjective lack of agency. It's the fact that they feel like they don't have a choice. And the purpose of ERP, the way that it really works, is by restoring a person's sense of agency, reminding them that they do have a choice. Does that make sense? So, I mean, summarizing, it's discarding the role of habituation, which streamlines what you're doing as exposure. And it's doing exposure for the purpose, not of habituation, but of restoring agency and eliminating compulsion and avoidance.
No, that makes sense.
I got a little lost in my meandering, but I think I got it all out.
Okay. Yeah, my next question then was, obviously, since we last spoke, you've decided to kind of categorize, if we can use that word, what you've basically just said as rumination-focused ERP or RF-ERP, to distinguish it from ERP. Why go down that path?
Yeah, so for a long period of time, I specifically did not want to name it. And there were several reasons for that. First of all, I didn't want anybody to think that I was like trying to invent something, like trying to be important. And so I was happy. I didn't want to give it its own name. That was first of all. I also didn't want to undermine faith in ERP. I didn't want people to say, oh, you know, by criticizing ERP, you're making people not do a treatment that works, even though that doesn't really make sense since nobody said ERP is perfect and we're really just like tweaking it and, you know, same as like inhibitory learning. But I didn't want to undermine faith in ERP. And then I think also I was subject to the same the same idealization of ERP that a lot of people in the community are. For whatever reason, we have this idea that ERP is supposed to be perfect, even though that's not the data, right? There's no research study that shows that if you take people with OCD and you give them ERP, that all of them get all the way better, right? What we know is that it gets a lot of people a lot of the way better. But we still have this idea that it's this perfect treatment. And therefore, anytime that it fails, we're looking at ourselves as patients or therapists and thinking that there's something wrong with us, which is interesting. So similarly, I was looking for the right way to make ERP right, the right way to do ERP, assuming that ERP is all the way right, all the way correct. And if you just get it exactly right, that's the right, then it'll solve the whole problem. And the reality is, like, it doesn't have to be perfectly correct. Anyway, or I should say perfectly ideal. It doesn't have to be this perfect treatment. In sum, despite all these factors, at some point you get different enough that you have to call a spade and own that what you're doing is significantly different from ERP. That's why I call it rumination-focused ERP. It's still ERP. We are still confronting triggers. We are still eliminating compulsion and avoidance, right? So the nuts and bolts are there, but how we're doing it, why we're doing it, and exactly what we're doing are different enough that it deserves to be distinguished.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for explaining and yeah, giving your reasons. Okay. So inhibitory learning. So there you talked about, you did mention inhibitory learning and you talked about habituation. Habituation isn't the method you choose or like. Inhibitory learning maybe fits a bit better. I guess maybe could you just expand a bit more on your view versus, say, habituation?
Sure. Yeah. So you mean my view versus inhibitory learning or versus habituation?
Both, please.
Okay. So let's start with habituation. I just don't believe that habituation to anxiety really exists. And I know I hesitate to say that in an unqualified way, but at the end of the day, it's the truth. I don't believe in it. So I also think that including habituation in your conceptualization of how ERP works derails treatment and leads you to do things that don't make sense, leads you to do things that don't actually help. I think that having it in mind when you're designing an exposure will very often misguide the exposure. Okay. So that we are definitely nothing to do with habituation. Inhibitory learning is not against this model, but it's sort of not at the heart of this model. So first of all, I want to define my terms and make sure that I'm not talking past anyone. What I understand inhibitory learning to be is that we're disconfirming an expected outcome. So if you thought that stepping on the crack would kill your mother, we're going to step on the crack and voila, it didn't kill your mother. I think that in the vast majority of cases, assuming that's what we mean by inhibitory learning, I think that in the vast majority of cases, that's not relevant because most people with OCD don't actually think that's going to happen. They just feel obligated to make sure that it doesn't happen by eliminating the possibility by doing this thing. So I think that showing them that you step on a crack and your mother doesn't die, I think that that is not quite relevant in most cases. Even in cases where a person does have a certain expected outcome and we are disconfirming it, I still, like, let's say you thought that if you, set a boundary with someone, let's say that's the exposure to say no, that they would not be your friend or whatever. And let's say it's a successful behavioral experiment and you learn from that something positive, that's valuable. But I don't think that that's what's at the heart of what makes ERP work. I think that at the heart of what makes ERP work is restoring a person's sense of agency, because the totality of a compulsion is your subjective feeling that you don't have a choice. And if you feel that you have a choice, if you know that you have a choice, then it's not a compulsion anymore. In other words, no matter how extreme a behavior is that you're doing, if you know and really feel that you could do it or not do it, and it's totally up to you, that's no longer a compulsion. And so I think that restoring that sense of agency is at the heart of ERP. So let's use the same example, the person who's setting a boundary. I would say even if that person sets a boundary and things blow up and it's not good, I still think the exposure has accomplished its goal because we've restored this person's knowledge that they have the ability to do that. And I think that that is really the crux of the treatment. I think that if you are approaching ERP from the perspective of restoring agency and eliminating compulsion and avoidance, you cannot go wrong. I think that if you are thinking in terms of habituation, you will very much go wrong. And I think that if you're thinking in terms of inhibitory learning, it's like you're not going to do a bad exposure, but I think it doesn't quite get at the heart of what this disorder is about and therefore what this treatment should be about.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for distinguishing. And the next bit was, so you mentioned it the first time we spoke, but then when I was reading through your articles today, you wrote the goal of an exposure is never to feel anxious. Obviously, now this is very different to ERP as usual, where you're effectively facing your fears and it's spiking your anxiety. So why write this?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I would ask the opposite question, which is, why would being anxious be helpful? Why would it help to make somebody anxious? And the only answer that you can give is habituation. It only makes sense if you think that being anxious makes you less anxious. Hmm. So once you discard that idea, the whole question is gone. Why we're so sort of we're so used to this idea that of how exposure works through habituation that we take for granted that, oh, of course you should be anxious on purpose. Like that's the goal, lean into it or bring it on or whatever. Yeah. But really that is a very counterintuitive idea. Why would being anxious make you feel better? Right. Mm-hmm. So I would argue that, that is not the case. And moreover, I would argue that what we want to teach people is that because anxiety is a consequence or really a reflection of rumination, that they can control their anxiety by controlling their rumination. And therefore, by doing that, we're showing a person that they have a lot more control over their anxiety than they ever thought they did. And by weaving that into ERP, we can show them that they can eliminate avoidance and they can eliminate compulsions and they can confront triggers, all while not feeling very anxious, as long as they rein in compulsive rumination. And that is a powerful thing to teach somebody, especially because so many people with OCD, present company included historically, feel like we are at the whims of our anxiety. We feel like, you know, you could wake up and it's just a bad day and there's nothing you can do about it. You're just totally powerless. And teaching people that they actually can control that, eliminating the fear of the anxiety itself, is like, unimaginably important. So anyway, I think I meandered away from the question. The question was, why would you not want to be anxious during an exposure? The answer is because the only reason to be anxious during an exposure is habituation. And if you're anxious during an exposure, then great, we've shown you that you can do this thing, but we've shown you that you do this thing and you feel terrible. I would like to show you that you can do this thing and not feel terrible. So it's a significantly different approach.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it makes sense. And obviously inhibitory learning started that journey of moving away of you don't necessarily need to feel anxious because we're not habituating. You can get the new learning even if you're not anxious doing this exposure. So it's not, yeah, it's in the same ballpark as what you're saying.
Yeah, you could frame everything that I'm saying in terms of learning. You can't frame it in terms of habituation, but you could say, oh, I'm learning that if I don't ruminate, then I feel better. That's valid. And I wrote an article that talked about it that way a few years ago. And like, I don't think that article is wrong, but I think conceptualizing in terms of agency is, in terms of agency and in terms of rumination, is a sharper model that will guide treatment more precisely. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't think learning is wrong. It is learning. That's a correct way to think about it. But I think in terms of streamlining treatment and in terms of making sure that we're doing the most precise interventions possible, that we're really hitting the nail on the head in terms of what we are doing, why we are doing it, how we are doing it, I think that thinking in terms of agency, restoring agency, and eliminating compulsion and avoidance is the most exact, is will guide you to the most exact treatment. I think it's the most direct, streamlined approach.
Yeah.
So for example, I was talking to someone who said something about a patient who had taken, we were talking about this model, and she was talking about how a patient who had taken days to habituate to something. And the way I would conceptualize that is that this patient ruminated about it for days until they stopped. And when they stopped feeling anxious. And so we can teach people that by, we can first of all teach people that they can stop ruminating and how to do that. And then we can teach people that by doing that, they can control their experience of anxiety. And we can teach people that they can control their experience of anxiety even when they are confronting a trigger. I'm scared, right? I might have an initial moment of fear, sometimes not, but I might have that initial moment of fear. But if I don't engage at all, I don't then go off to the races trying to solve the problem or engaging mentally or directing attention, I can actually rein in my experience of anxiety. Now, a lot of people will say, I don't ruminate and I'm still anxious. Okay. And I think that here it's very important that we say that the term rumination can be defined different ways. I'm defining it very broadly to mean any sort of mental engagement with this problem at all. The fact that you're aware of this problem is not, that's not rumination, but directing attention towards it, trying to solve it, any of that is rumination. And I would argue that if you are not doing any of that, actually you will not continue to be anxious. And so even though you might not think you're ruminating, your definition of rumination might be too narrow. And that might be why you're still feeling anxious. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay. So when we're doing an exposure, I want the person to learn from the exposure that they can rein in their rumination and not feel anxious. And therefore, I am monitoring their anxiety level and making sure that it's close to zero so that they can have that experience. So for example, and this is an example I gave in an article, let's say a very typical exposure might be we have a person who's afraid of harming their child, and so they won't use a knife around the child, right? So the exposure is going to be they're going to use a knife around the child, obviously, because it's an avoidance, so we're doing it on purpose. So I think that in your classical model, you would want this person to potentially imagine attacking the child on purpose, or you might want them to feel anxious on purpose, right? I would say that if this person is imagining attacking the child or feeling anxious, that's rumination, that's a compulsion. And what I actually want this person to do is to not think about it at all, to not engage with it at all, to not keep their guard up, to not direct attention, to not engage mentally with this at all. And they will find that if they do that, they can keep their anxiety level really close to zero. And then what they've learned is that they have a lot more control over this than they ever thought they did. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad you brought that up because that was actually my next question, that exact example you gave in the article. So let's say this mother who is avoiding knives because, as you said, she doesn't want to attack her child, but she fears she's going to do it. And you're trying to keep her SUDS level, her anxiety close to zero.
Let's say close to zero.
Close to zero, yeah. Two, three and below, for example.
Close to zero.
Okay. One or zero.
Distinction. If somebody says two or three, there's some engagement.
Okay.
There is some engagement there. If somebody says not exactly a zero, right? But it's like basically nothing, that's good.
0.5.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I get it. What was I going to say? So hang on a minute. I want to remember this question. Okay. So you're doing the exercise. She's not avoiding the knives anymore. And you're checking in with her, trying to make sure she's not doing anything and her anxiety is at 0 or 0.5 or whatever it is. But let's say it's at a 3 or a 4. What are you then saying to her to kind of...
Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to add that in this model, we start with how to stop ruminating. Okay. So before we do any exposure, this person has been taught how to stop ruminating, has been problem solving any issues they're having with that, and has been implementing that consistently. And only once we're doing that, only once we have that response prevention in place, do we then start exposures. So basically in that moment, if this person is ruminating, we're going to throw back to everything that they learned in the beginning of the treatment. And basically how to stop ruminating is a multiple choice test, right? There are only basically 5 options of what could be going wrong. So, I mean, hopefully the easiest thing is, are you ruminating? And they say yes, and they stop. right? If they say, I don't know, I'm trying not to, but I'm still having trouble, then we go to our multiple choice test. Are you directing attention? Are you trying to figure something out? Are you using distraction in an unhelpful way? You know, it's very limited what the issues can be. But I mean, the shortest answer is the person who's doing this exposure and rumination-focused ERP is the same person who already went through a couple of sessions of exactly how to stop ruminating.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. Yeah. The other thing, and I'm sure we've addressed this, but the thing that sticks out in my mind, and maybe it will stick out in others, is for a mother who is like having these intrusive thoughts around harming her child, it's unbelievably shocking and scary. So I don't know, I guess I'm baffled that we can get her so low so quickly, but I'm guessing you're saying that if she removes the rumination, or removes, not the right word, but you know where I'm going with this, then the anxiety drops.
If she doesn't engage at all. I mean, I think the starting point for your question is that the idea of intrusive thoughts is already very confusing.
Yeah.
So what we're really saying is, here is a mother who constantly ruminates about harming her child.
Okay.
Right? Where she doesn't really have intrusive thoughts. I mean, she does. Yeah, a thought occurs to her and it's very scary. But really what's happening is this person is constantly ruminating, constantly trying to figure out if they would do it.
Yeah.
Constantly trying to revisit something and not feel what they were feeling, et cetera. Okay. So when you put it that way, it's a lot simpler. We're saying, here is a mother who constantly ruminates about hurting her child. And if she stops doing that, she feels a lot better. Mm. And then it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Yeah. And then she may get the odd one or two intrusive thoughts that come in again. But then if she's not engaging in the rumination, it's not bothering her.
And furthermore, what do we even mean by one or two intrusive thoughts that come in? What we really mean is the thought will occur to her.
Yeah.
And she will not engage with it at all.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not even coming in. It's occurring to her.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is you can't stop those thoughts because they're less than we think, but you can't stop them. They're automatic.
Yes to everything you're saying. I would just like to sort of highlight the fact that the thought occurring to you is only a very liminal, peripheral thing or event, I should say. Yeah. It's not when people are like, anybody who has a vivid visual of something or an ongoing visual playing out, they're ruminating. You can't have a vivid visual or an ongoing visual without doing it on purpose. That's a person who's imagining it to try to figure something out, right? The thing that we're saying this person can't control is hardly anything. It's either the thought occurring to them or their awareness that they're scared of this, that this question exists. Hmm. Does that make sense? We could even go further and say, instead of thinking of it as intrusive thoughts, think of it as this question that is haunting them. This question just exists. It exists. Don't engage with it. You're reminded of the question. Still don't engage with it. You've spent your whole life up until now trying to answer this question. Our new strategy is we are not going to answer this question. Hmm. Instead of thinking about it as intrusive thoughts, let's just think about it as this question that exists that haunts me.
Okay. So, I guess the term don't engage with it resonates with me quite well, because I think if I look back at my own sort of journey, I did come to a point where I started to think, just don't engage.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I'm saying.
Hmm.
Just don't engage.
And over time it went. But when I engaged, it came back with fury. So it was...
Mm-hmm. Or put another way, you're saying when you engaged, it came back with a fury, as if your engagement led to... I would say it's much more direct than that.
Okay.
When you engaged, or put another way, when you started ruminating, you were trying to answer this question. And the more that you engaged in trying to answer this question, the more obviously you were thinking about this question, right? It's not like we don't need a system of, habituation, negative reinforcement to explain that if you are trying to answer this question, you will be thinking about this question. And if you make a decision to stop trying to answer this question, you will not be thinking about this question. In other words, it's much simpler and more straightforward than the behaviorist model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. That was a useful distinction. Yeah. And I was going to bring up that example because I think it was fruitful to explain. So we may have touched on this. There's so much going on in my head at the minute, I can't articulate it. But I guess when I was listening back to our first conversation today, something that really stood out for me was where someone, okay, you're kind of arguing that most people have rumination. And in fact, for most people, that is the crux of it. But, you know, obviously some people will also have hand washing or checking or whatever the physical compulsion is, or hiding of the knives. Mm-hmm. I guess it was more like an order question, because do you focus on the rumination first and then go to any other mm-hmm. compulsions, or mm-hmm. do you do the physical first, then rumination?
This is an excellent question. So so I'm going to answer this in two parts.
Okay.
Number one is, we're not just thinking of rumination as a specific compulsion that some people have. We're thinking of rumination as actually the cornerstone of anxiety disorders. When somebody has an anxiety disorder, what they're telling you is, I'm somebody who ruminates. I have social anxiety, I'm somebody who ruminates about that. I have emetophobia, I'm somebody who ruminates about that, along with a constellation, potentially, of other forms of avoidance and compulsion, right? So let's use emetophobia as an example. So yes, what's the difference between, meaning a phobia really talks about it in terms of fear, I'm afraid of vomit, but there's also a tremendous amount of anxiety and rumination around that. It's not just that when I vomit, I get very scared. It's that I spend my whole life thinking about, being anxious about, ruminating about, right? The possibility of encountering vomit, or what I would do if I encountered vomit, or how to not encounter vomit, whether that person's about to vomit, etc. That's not fear, that's anxiety, right? Mm. So for example, I have a fear of heights. When I'm in a high place, I get very scared. I do not have a phobia of heights. I mean, at least I would never present for treatment for a phobia of heights, because I don't think about it. I don't ruminate about it. It doesn't run my life. I'm not thinking about it when it's not present. Mm. That makes sense? Yeah. So that's number one, is that we're not just thinking about rumination as a symptom in certain people. We're thinking of it as actually sort of the cognitive side of what people affectively describe as anxiety. Okay, that's number one. Number two is, like I said, you asked, do we start with rumination before anything else? So I'm going to answer that in two parts. Number one is, we start, in my practice, we start every single case with how to stop ruminating, because it is such a big part of the picture. So before anything else, case formulation, number one, what is going on? And then number two, how to stop ruminating. And then we go from there. Exposure only afterwards. So that's in general. But I think what you're really asking about is, how does rumination interact with these other symptoms? And I think that that is different in different cases. And that's what I would call a rumination-focused case formulation. The question of, how do these things fit together? And I will give you I'll give you a couple of examples. And there's also an article on the website. So one example of this would be somebody who has contamination OCD. And let's say this is somebody who has contamination OCD, and they're not afraid of harm happening to someone because of contamination. They're afraid of just the experience, the feeling of contamination getting out of hand, and then never being able to escape it, mm-hmm. right? That would be, I think, like a subtype of contamination OCD. So in those cases, keeping track of the contamination, meaning ruminating about the contamination, is actually perpetuating the experience of contamination. I experience things as contaminated because mentally I'm keeping track of it, right? And so as long as I continue to do that, things will continue to be mentally, quote unquote, contaminated. And so that would be an example of a rumination-focused case formulation. This is not going to get better until you stop keeping track of it. And so our exposures are going to be aimed at contaminating stuff and no longer keeping track of it. Okay, that's an example. Another example would be urges and compulsive behavior. This is, rumination has tremendous, like unimaginable explanatory power in terms of urges. And this applies to rituals, you know, not the ones that are aimed at like magically preventing things, but when somebody has an urge, like just right, or just right OCD, I have to do that, or I won't feel right until I do it, or I have to do that ritual. Again, with no magical component, just that this urge is never going to go away until I do it. Or similarly, things that might not present as OCD, like a lot of things that we call like addictions could be called compulsive behaviors. So for example, we could have somebody who has a compulsion to, I'm going to use a real example. You could have somebody who has a compulsion to watch porn, okay, which they might or might not call OCD when they present for treatment. But basically, in all of these cases, when a person has an urge and they ruminate about whether to fulfill the urge, am I going to do it? Am I not going to do it? What am I going to do about this feeling? I don't want to do it, but this is never going to go away. Doing that perpetuates the urge. It keeps them in that state of tension. If this person doesn't know how to stop ruminating, they have no other way out of this other than to fulfill the urge. And over the course of, you know, weeks and months and years, they learn that don't even bother, you're going to do it, right? So this person has either not done the urge and felt anxious until they did it, right? And not done the whatever the urge is for, and felt anxious until they actually did it, or else they just did it. They've never had the experience of, I have the urge and then I mentally walk away from it. I stop ruminating about it. Simply by teaching a person that they can stop ruminating and thus make this urge disappear is like magic. It's like giving them a back door they never knew existed. They've been like, you know, playing with this front door, frantically trying to open it. And meanwhile, there was a back door they could walk out the whole time. And so people just write OCD, people with random rituals that they have the urge to do, and people with other forms of compulsions, so again, going back to rumination-focused case formulation, understanding what they're doing in terms of the fact that they're ruminating and that ruminating perpetuates this urge is hugely important to treatment. And what we would want to do is first teach them and then do exposures that are aimed at bringing up the urge and then not ruminating and consequently seeing that, oh, you can make it go away if you don't ruminate about it. And then all of a sudden you don't need to do it anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Or I want to give one more example. Another example would be people who are afraid of feeling guilty forever, right? Let's say we have somebody who goes to a party and then they have like an awkward interaction. And then afterwards they're ruminating about the possibility that they hurt somebody's feelings, right? And let's say they're doing that because they're afraid that otherwise they will have done something terrible and then they will feel guilty forever because they failed to, you know, remediate it. Okay. So this person is like, oh, it's probably fine. But then they're like, well, I can't think that. No, what if it's not fine? I need to figure out how they need to come up with how maybe it wasn't fine, because they're afraid that if they let themselves off the hook, they will fail to correct it and then they'll be guilty forever. So this person is going to come up with every possible scenario in which they could potentially be guilty, every possible reason they could be guilty. The same thing applies to regret. Every possible reason I might regret this decision. In so doing, they are manufacturing the experience of guilt or the experience of regret. So they're actually, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in which they are creating the very feeling that they are terrified of experiencing forever. And then they look at themselves and they say, see, it's real. I really could feel guilty forever. Mm-hmm. So that would be just another example of a rumination-focused case formulation. You would want this person to see that a lot of their emotional distress is a consequence of the fact that they are trying to figure something out. Yeah, those are just a few examples. Yeah. So I do think rumination and broadly speaking, you want to do all exposures in the context of not ruminating, but then we get more specific in terms of specific cases and the role that rumination is playing in those cases in particular. And that was a very long answer to your very short question.
No, it was a good answer. I appreciate it. I wasn't sure about that question, but someone in me kind of wanted to ask it. So a couple listener questions now. Mm-hmm. So these actually came up from the first time we spoke, and I know you got loads of questions, but I just wanted to ask these couple, and we've probably addressed it a bit, and we did address them in the first, but I think they're worth asking again. So the first one is from a listener: what's the difference between thinking normally and ruminating? I get tripped up there and can't decide whether I'm ruminating or just having a standard thought, judgment, angry moment, etc.
Right. I love this question, and the answer is very simple. The answer is that in general, what makes a compulsion is that you feel like you don't have a choice. If you are doing something because you want to do it, it's not a compulsion. And that means no matter how extreme your behavior is, no matter how much you are an outlier from the rest of humanity, if you like what you're doing and you're doing it on purpose, that's not OCD. The experience of a compulsion is that I don't want to do this, but I don't have a choice, right? It's a conflict. So if you are thinking about something, so in other words, it's not objectively, oh, is this thought or is this standard of health the eating or this standard of sexual protection, is this objectively OCD? It is totally subjective. It is about you in that moment and whether you want to be doing this or you feel like you don't have a choice, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to be thinking about XYZ, okay. If you don't want to be thinking about XYZ and you feel like you don't have a choice, that's what makes it a compulsion. We want to show you, yes, you do have a choice. You can stop ruminating in or out. Do you want to or not? That could mean that the same thought process could be, for example, if I am thinking about OCD and I'm thinking about how to treat a certain case or how to conceptualize a certain thing, is that rumination? Well, no, if I want to be thinking about it, but if I'm with my husband and I want to be present, and instead I'm off, you know, trying to solve this problem and I feel like I can't stop, that's rumination. And yes, I can stop and I need to stop, right? Or, I think that suffices to answer that question. Yeah. The point is that it's all about agency. What characterizes OCD is the lack of agency, and the whole point of treatment is to restore agency.
Yeah. Yeah, very good point. And I guess something maybe to clarify is with the I want to be doing it. I think sometimes with OCD, you may feel you want to be doing something, but maybe deep down, you know, I really don't want to be doing this, but I'm so scared. The part of me tells me I need to keep doing this.
Yeah, clearly, in other words, what you're getting at is that the question of do you want to be doing this is a little more nuanced than just yes or no, right? But the point is that you have a choice.
Yeah.
If you know that you have a choice, not just rationally, but emotionally, you feel equipped in this moment to do it or don't do it. It's your choice, right? Then we've accomplished our goal.
Yeah, good point.
Nobody's presenting for treatment because they have too many choices. I mean, that's not true, actually. A lot of people are presenting for treatment because they have too many choices, but nobody's presenting for OCD treatment. Yeah. They're presenting because they feel like they don't have a choice about something.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't stop doing this thing.
I can't stop doing this thing. I can't stop thinking about this thing, etc. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. The next listener question was, the hard part is recognizing when you're doing something, and doing something is in speech marks, i.e. rumination. How do you recognize when you're doing something?
How do you recognize when you're doing something? So I think this is sort of, there's another possibility of what the first question meant that I think this question is getting at. So I'll answer that together. So the language or framework that I like to use for describing what's going on mentally is four things. Something being in your awareness, a thought occurring to you, being aware of something, directing attention, and analyzing. So a thought occurring to you, awareness, attention, analysis. Sorry, her question was?
Let me get my notes. Recognizing when you're doing something. How to recognize when you're doing something.
Yeah, I think what he or she is asking is where the line is between a thought occurring to you and then mentally doing something about it. Mm-hmm. And my answer is that the line is between awareness and attention. A thought occurring to you, you're not doing anything. You're aware of an issue, you're not doing anything. The second you start directing your attention to it or analyzing it or trying to solve it, that's when you're doing something. So it's very important to differentiate between something being in awareness and directing attention. At the same time, it's crucial to point out that that line is blurry and that trying to thread that needle exactly precisely is going to get you into trouble. So we, on the one hand, dialectically need to draw a very sharp conceptual distinction between attention and awareness. But on the other hand, we need to let that line be blurry, because if we try to get it exactly right, we're just going to end up ruminating about that.
Yeah.
I think that that's what that person is asking. If they're asking, like, how do you become aware that you're ruminating? I think that what I tell people is just as soon as you catch it, eliminate it. And if you keep on doing that, you'll eventually catch it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I like that. So thank you for those listener questions. My next question was kind of, who else do you know that kind of uses this approach to treating OCD?
Right,
I don't necessarily mean names, but
the only people I know who for sure do it this way are my associates in my practice.
Okay.
Who are wonderful and amazing. And other than that, I know I'm doing a training now, training therapists in this approach. So I assume that those clinicians are at least to some extent using this approach. But I can't know for sure whether they're, you know, using it exclusively or integrating it with other things. So as far as I know for sure, just our practice.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. Okay. So yeah. So you did mention something earlier, and I can't remember, the wording was brilliant, and I can't remember what it was because it fits perfectly with this question, which was how do you help a client identify that they're ruminating when they say they aren't ruminating? That was it. You said something along the lines of maybe their understanding or definition of rumination is too narrow.
Yeah. I think that, yeah. And I think this is when people sort of bristle at my assertion that everybody's ruminating when they're anxious, it's usually because they think of ruminating as very discrete, very limited and very discrete phenomena. They think ruminating is when I specifically am sitting down and trying to remember what I said, or ruminating is when I'm specifically sitting there sort of, or I'm specifically coming up with reasons that I'm XYZ. So I'm thinking of ruminating in a much more unitary, meaning it's all one thing. This feeling of engaging with this problem, directing attention towards it, trying to solve it, broadly speaking, not the specifics of what I'm doing in that moment. That's my definition of rumination. Any engagement with this problem, sort of, again, going back to the idea that instead of thinking about obsessive thoughts, we can think about a question that haunts me, right? Or an issue that's a problem that I feel I need to solve. Any engagement with that problem, any directing attention towards that problem, any trying to solve that problem is rumination in my book.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question?
It does. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Broadening the definition much more. It seems softer as well. Softer in the sense of, like, as you were talking there, more blurred lines, but it made more sense than...
I think thinking about it as, again, a unitary construct, it's all part of this one big thing. It's not discrete little thing. It's not discrete behaviors. It's not like washing your hands over here and doing a ritual over there. It's this place that I go to mentally, this mental engagement.
Yeah. Okay. No, it makes sense. So I guess that was all my questions. I think we've done a good job at extending from the first one. If people haven't heard that, definitely check out that. I think this episode stands for itself. So I guess lastly, is there anything else that we've missed that you wish you could have said or that needs expanding on?
Yeah, I think what I would want people to know about this approach is that it is incredibly simple, and it is simpler than ERP as usual. So lest anyone think that this is like very complicated and takes years of training, and that, you know, it's inaccessible, whether you're a patient or a therapist listening, what I want you to know is that it's actually extremely simple. It's actually an extremely parsimonious, clear, straightforward model that actually takes a pretty messy ERP, where there are lots of questions about what to do as exposure and why to do it and how to do it. And it actually streamlines all of that and says the whole purpose, OCD is compulsion and avoidance. ERP is eliminating compulsion and avoidance. OCD is, I feel like I don't have a choice. ERP is showing a person that they have a choice. What do? Eliminate avoidance, confront triggers only in order to practice eliminating compulsions. That's the whole treatment. Anybody can do it. How to stop ruminating is not complicated. It's not like you do not need to see Michael Greenberg to learn how to stop ruminating. It is a multiple choice test. There are very few things that can happen. I think the resources on the website are sufficient to learn. And if they're not, I'm going to improve them. I'm working on it. I'm working as fast as I can. This is actually an extremely simple model. And I think that I don't want people to see this as like, we're selling this product and you have to go to this like Tony Robbins training and pay $5 million. This is simple. Anybody can do this. Anybody can get trained in this. The training that I'm doing for other therapists now is not 10 years long. It is 4 sessions long. I think that basically it's very straightforward. Clearly there is an art to it. Clearly people are complicated. Clearly understanding what's happening and when it's happening and why it's happening is a whole therapy. But the skeleton, these particular skills of how to stop ruminating, how to incorporate that into exposure, and what to do as exposure. This stuff is super simple and clean.
Good way to end. And like I said earlier, I will link to your articles in the show notes. And obviously we've got the first episode we did together. So yeah, thank you so much for talking about this, expanding.
I appreciate it.
Brilliant.
Very nice to see you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.